Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Jason Reed. Jason Reed is a partner at CEO Coaching International, where he coaches CEOs to achieve sustainable success. As the co-founder of National Services Group, he leads a team of over 2,500 employees across three nationwide brands. A visionary entrepreneur and devoted family man, Jason's life took a transformative turn after the heartbreaking loss of his 14-year-old son, Ryan, to suicide in 2018. In response, he founded TellMyStory.org, a nonprofit dedicated to educating, and empowering parents with the resources they need to support their children's mental health. Through its sister organization, Mental Wellness Media, Jason works to raise awareness and spark meaningful conversations through impactful media projects. These initiatives, including the TEDx talks and documentary films, Tell My Story, and What I Wish My Parents Knew, are part of his mission to help parents and children communicate more openly and understand each other's mental health struggles. And with that, Jay, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been looking forward to our conversation for some time now.
Thank you, Dave. Me too. I think I sound a lot better on paper than I actually am. Thanks for the intro.
Hey, I ask this of anybody who has about multiple categories in the fire. Is like, when do you sleep?
I do a lot of different things, and I'm lucky in the sense that I have amazing people who do everything. They run all the businesses, they run my life, and I get to spend my time hanging out and talking, spending time with people like you, and really trying to make the leaders in my organization better leaders.
It was a pleasure working, and I got to give a shout out to your assistant, Vanessa. She was great to work with through the whole process, very competent, very professional, very quick to respond, and that made my job a lot easier, getting this together with you. So,
right, because you're waiting for me to respond, it's going to be a while.
Yes. Well, she obviously does her job well, and I teach my students, I said, if you want to get to the guy at the top or the person at the top, you have to be nice to the people that can get them there. So treat every executive assistant, every office manager with respect and dignity. If you don't, it'll be the next century before you get to see that individual.
It's such good advice for kids in school these days and people in general, because not that I'm that special, but I'm super busy and she is the gatekeeper.
Well, we have multiple categories going on, Jay.
Yeah. It's an honor. Not an honor. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's an honor to have you here, and I'm anxious to get going and find out more about you and find out about Ryan and find out about your mission with TellMyStory.org and everything else that you got going on. My first question is, I always like to get an understanding of the person that the family has lost through the eyes of one of the parents. So tell our audience about your son, Ryan.
Ryan had just turned 14. On March 12th, 2018. And by all accounts, he's just a fun kid. He's a great kid. There's no problems. He didn't get in trouble. Not any more than any other kid. He was moody time to time. But I had three other older kids, so I thought he was the least moody of the four of them. We spent a lot of time together. I travel for business. You know, I'm gone 2 to 4 days a week. But when I'm home, I'm home. So I'd be, you know, we'd have dinner, and him and I would go down and watch a Marvel movie or the series Grimm with the monsters and stuff. We used to go watch that at night. And I thought we were close. And we were. Dinner was always around the table. We have a no cell phone, no TV rule at the dinner table. Always have, because it's all conversations, right? So we had, as a family, we sit around, we talk. And we had a little fun thing going for years. We called dinner conversations. And it would be whoever came up with the funniest thing at the dinner table. The funniest thing that was said at the dinner table became the dinner conversation that got posted on Facebook for everybody to laugh at. And we'd all get a kick out of watching what comments or what people who laughed at what. And we did that for years and years and years. And that summer before Ryan passed, he actually, people said, you got to turn that into a book. You got to turn that into a book. And so Ryan took all the posts off of Facebook and turned it into the book Dinner Conversations, which was meant to help parents understand, kids understand, you got to sit around, you got to talk, like, put away the phones and talk. And it's funny with that, is it took him all summer long to do that. And it's because I paid him by the hour. So all that said, Ryan was hiding the truth about who he was from us. He was a very sad person, but we never saw him. And that brings you to, you know, March 18th. Kim and I were on vacation for her birthday, and he planned it and called us, texted all of us at the same time. He had prepared texts saying goodbye. And we were in Puerto Vallarta, and it was almost 1 a.m. our time. And you can imagine how things went from there. And we fought to get home, couldn't get home until the next day. So we got home, he was in the hospital, and, you know, 5 days later, we had to take him off life support. It was life-changing, to say the least, and we didn't see it coming. Now, you look back, and I can say that the signs were there. He was moody, spending more time in his room, but he did a really good job. And, you know, this is where I run afoul of a lot of the suicide folks out there, AFSP, Word Help, all the big organizations. And these people say, well, you can't use the word commit. If someone committed suicide, you don't want to say that, because you commit adultery, you commit blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, but you also commit to things, right? I committed to doing a triathlon. I committed to my marriage. And unfortunately, he committed in his own mind to doing this. He researched it. He planned it. He knew where I was going to be out of town. He knew. So he did commit to it.
The individuals you've dealt with, how much guilt do survivors of suicide have because of the actions of their loved ones? Do you run into that a lot? Have you run into that a lot with the individuals that you've companioned, either individually or through Tell My Story?
Well, I think it's natural, right? Even to this day, 7 years later, like, I wish I had caught that. Wish I had asked these questions differently. So there's a degree of guilt, no matter how well-adjusted you are. But there's always the, you missed it. So I would say that, you know, we have developed a life, and we definitely miss Ryan, and there's definitely sad days. March is a hard month. But we're able to move on because I have three other kids. I have a marriage. I have people count on me. I need to do things. I'm making the best out of this for as many people as I possibly can. I'm trying to teach people from it. But I definitely met people who unfortunately don't recover, right? Mm-hmm. They feel so deeply sad about what happened. They can't bring themselves out of it. And it's sad to watch. And I think that if they were able to understand, at least what I believe is, that's not your loved ones want. You know, they didn't do this to you. Ryan didn't do this to us. He didn't even think about the grief it caused us. He was in so much pain that he didn't know any other way out. And he was, you know, there's no other way to say it, he was mentally ill, right? You don't do that if you're not. He couldn't see the reality. And so I like to think now that wherever he's at, he looks down and goes, wish I was there. Yeah. Wish this didn't happen, but it did. And so some people can't get past it. They crawl into a bottle. They leave their friend. I mean, most people get divorced. 85% of people get divorced because they can't handle it. Families fall apart. Luckily, none of that's happened to us. And I feel very, very bad for the people it does happen to. I wish they could understand that they still have a life.
My daughter Janine, she did. I call it transitioned to a new existence. Other people call it passed away or died, however you conceptualize death. And she transitioned on March 1st. So March was a typically, and this was over 22 years ago, March was a traditionally bad month for me in the early stages of grief. I had guilt that I didn't see the sign of her cancer sooner. I had guilt that I couldn't talk her into another clinical trial. I had guilt oozing out of every orifice of my body, literally. And it with support with the passage of time, I learned that my daughter not only lived life on her own terms, but she was going to die on her own terms. And that helped me, in addition to the support I have, manage that guilt. But, you know, it throws our world into disarray. I mean, everything, the assumptions that we had about the world prior to our children passing or dying or transitioning was a lot different after, and we had to really rebuild that. I had to take a look at everything that I stood for, all of my values and priorities, if I were going to reengage again. And you made a very relevant point. Some people don't get past it. Some people don't choose to get past it. They'll stay wallowed in the muck, and they'll just stay stuck in pain, where the choices we have is we can stay stuck, or we can, as a result of our challenges, try to move forward and reengage in life with meaning. And it sounds like obviously something you've done and something that I have strived to do in the 22 years since my daughter has passed.
I mean, when you think about guilt, there's things you should be guilty of if you harm someone. I mean, if you've killed someone and you're guilty, you should feel guilty the rest of your life.
Yep.
You should wallow. You absolutely should, right? But in this case, where we lost a loved one to something we didn't do, or we wish we had done something differently, it's a different kind of guilt. There's really, I hate to say it this way, but that guilt has no purpose. It's not solving anything. We're not supposed to be feeling guilty about these things. We're supposed to move on with their lives and help other people. I don't live my life for myself. I live my life for my wife, my kids, and all the people I try to help. All the things I try to do, I try to make people's lives better. That's my purpose, right? Along mm-hmm. the way, do I build businesses and make some money? Sure. And I get to do good things with that money. But I mean, guilt has no real purpose. And some people don't hear that, but that's how I look at it.
I mean, guilt's a natural part of the grief process, and it's something that we have to deal with. But I think, like with anything, if we don't learn to manage it over time, it's going to consume us, and it's going to keep us stuck.
It does. So, but yeah, with sadness, yeah, all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, even though I'm at peace with my daughter's passing, and I know firmly where she is, and I know that she's a part of me, there are days that I still get sad. There are days that I want her here, but I realize that I can't yearn for something that I can't have, and I can't yearn for that for too long, but it's part of the human emotion. And the human experience is messy to begin with, and it's more messier when we have to deal with ongoing grief, but, you know, it's part of the life that we lead, and over time, hopefully, we can teach individuals to move through it and learn how to manage it and integrate it as part of who they are, so...
And I should do a little disclaimer here. Is these ideas that I'm going to share with you are mine. They're not. I don't have a degree in any of this stuff. I have lived experience, and I probably view things through a different lens than a lot of people do. But you know, just because I say it doesn't make it true. It just means my opinion.
You know, I think everybody's perspective is different. It depends on their unique situation, their unique beliefs. But it's everybody's going to grieve in their own way. Everybody's going to see their journey in their own way. It's not up to us to judge whose path is better than the others. It's up to us to walk on that path, understand that path, and take what we can from it that can help us. So, okay, we're going to do a before and after picture. Who is the Jason Reed before Ryan died? Who is the Jason Reed now, and what has changed for you, Jay?
I would say I'm a little, probably a lot more caring. People more willing to listen to their stuff, a little more patient. I never thought I'd be a charity guy. I thought charity would be something I spent my time on maybe when I retired, you know, give away a bunch of money when I die if I had it. I didn't spend any time on any of that kind of stuff. I didn't try to make the world a better place. I tried to make money for my family and myself, I guess. That was me before. me after, and I spent a lot more time trying to make a difference in people's lives. Be within the business, people have challenges and more willing to talk to them about it. Outside the business, people who are struggling, like trying to make a difference. So I think that's probably the biggest stuff. I mean, I'm definitely, if you tell my story, which is the bulk of what we do charity-wise, I spend a lot of time there. And I'm trying to help people understand what I missed and how they can better communicate with their kids. So that's probably the biggest stuff. I mean, I'm definitely leaning more into my creative side. I've got, you know, my partner, Kenny Goldstein, I met for Ocala Studios. You know, I'm having a lot more fun doing documentary films and music videos. We have albums, two of the albums behind us here. They all have mental wellness tweaks on them. So I get to spend a lot more time creatively, and that's fun. So I'm probably more well-rounded, a little more relaxed, even though I have, you know, Ryan always in my head. But yeah, I'd say that's kind of who I am now.
Yeah, and I've watched your documentaries, and I see how you position yourself with the young adults who are sharing their stories. And just body language-wise, you're very engaged. You show a sincere interest in hearing their stories, and there's a way that nonverbally you communicate a very empathic, compassionate stance when you're listening to these stories. And I can see that you're visibly affected by every and inspired by every story that you hear. And that comes across in both documentaries that I've seen, Jay.
Some stuff hasn't changed. I'm still on the disc score. I'm still 100D. I still drive. I'm still not patient. If you can't help yourself, I'm going to shoot you straight.
Mm-hmm.
I still work a lot. Both beyond telling my story, my other projects, my work. I'm still the 12-hour-a-day guy, 7 or 8 on Saturday and Sunday. But that's my choice, right? I love making a difference.
Well, as you said, we become more well-rounded. I think we get in parts of ourselves that, you know, touch with ourselves that we never thought existed. We end up accessing a new level of compassion, a new level of empathy, of premium on relationships. But for me, there's things that haven't changed either. I still work hard. I still work a lot. Sometimes I get impatient in certain situations, but in other ways, I'm more well-rounded. I put a premium on different things now than I did prior to my daughter's passing.
I'm also keenly aware of how short life can be.
Uh-huh.
How little time I might have left on this planet, even though it might be 30 years. 30 years doesn't seem like enough, right? It might be 40 years, it might be 20 years, but mm-hmm. Every day going, I'm not going to sit on that couch because there's not that many days left.
No. And you're right. I mean, I learned that no day is guaranteed and that we need to make the most of each day that the good Lord gives us to make a difference. Every day that I wake up, I express my gratitude for being allowed to wake up another day and do what I'm passionate about. So, why don't I ask you a question specific to men? From your perspective, what are the unique challenges that men face in processing grief, and how can human service professionals and even the women in their lives or their friends in their lives effectively support those challenges?
Well, that's a great question. I think that plays into what generation you came from. So Gen X guys, we don't have a lot of emotion. We hide them really well. We were trained at a young age to hide our emotions, right? Boys don't cry. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get going, right? Today's generation, men are more in touch with the feelings, I feel like. And so it all depends what you're talking about. But if we stick with guys my age or around that age, it's like we, as men over the age of 50, just say, maybe even the age of 45, we have always grown up with hiding our emotions. We've grown up with the idea that we are supposed to be providers first. We're supposed to protect our families. And that means never letting them see a sweat, right? And I lived that for sure. Like no one ever knew in my family what I was really going through. I was a bankrupt twice, lost the house. Nobody knew. All the struggles I've been having at work, all the struggles I have, I just don't talk about. So when reach happened with Ryan, when Ryan passed and I had my own grief to deal with, I didn't talk about it with my wife and kids. I dove into what I knew how to do. The day he passed, the day we turned him off to go off life support, I was already building the foundation. Because that's all I know how to do, work my way through stuff, right? Now, I eventually took me a couple of therapists the end of summer who I could talk to, I could feel comfortable talking to. But I can tell you, as a guy, you want to just try to push it deep down. I think a lot of men our age do. And that doesn't ever help, right? I see guys that do that, and I've talked to them, and I'm like, so how much have you been drinking for how long now? Because that's what it ends up being, right? They go to work, they come on the drink. Because that's a normal thing for us, right? You got to let it up somehow. And they end up getting divorced, right? Or their lives are just terrible. They're just grumpy guys for the rest of their lives.
Yep.
So I think I'm rambling a little bit, but I'm trying to place this in a way that makes sense because we are so different. When I look at myself versus my sons or my son-in-law, they're different men than I am. They're much more in touch with their emotions. They're much more in touch and able to have conversations, better conversations with their significant others than I am. So, but I've learned how to get better at it. I know that's the answer to your question, but I rambling too much.
No, it answers my question because I think you're right. I think guys in our generation, we have learned to kind of suppress our feelings because we've learned that feelings, if we express those, make us vulnerable, make us weak. But I'm a firm believer that we feel just as intensely as the women in our lives. We just deal with it differently. Like you said, you work through it. You were working, you know, the day after, you know, Ryan was off of life support because that's all you know how to do. Essentially, that's what I tell the females in my class. If you have a boyfriend that doesn't talk about his feelings and he's all of a sudden he's pissed off about something and he starts building an addition on your parents' house, he's upset because if he starts working through those feelings, that's how he's going to do it. He's going to try to find a solution to it and work through it as opposed to talk about it. So for me, I tell them, if you want to get kind of in touch with a guy's feelings, you got to ask them what they're thinking first. Guys are in their heads a lot. So if you ask them what they're thinking, they can tell you what they're feeling.
Yes. And we don't want to talk that much about it.
No.
It's like I just deal with it myself.
Yep.
But I think there's also like, you know, the flip side of being very emotional. And you know, I was talking to a younger guy in his early 40s. He was asking me about some business advice. And I said, well, my first advice to you is you're lazy. You need to go to work. You only work 4 hours a day. I'm like, what does your wife think about all this? Well, she wishes there were more money. I'm like, I'm like, some things don't change, right? Even the younger generation, if a woman wants to stay at home, she still looks at the man to be a provider. And if you're not going to be a provider, then and you're not going to go out there and get stuff done, not going to work very well.
Yeah.
So it's I think it's a tough world these days because women want their men to be sensitive and soft and loving and emotional and go kill the bear and bring home the food and fight off the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to do all those things, right? I can't do all those things.
No. No. But I think if we can understand how women process emotions and men process emotions, particularly in our generation, I think if we can understand that, respect that, I think it goes a long way towards building relationships or rebuilding relationships after loss.
Well, and I think to that point, like I handle my stuff like digging in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did the way you and your wife handled grief, did that present challenges for the two of you in the early stages of Ryan's death?
I believe I needed to get out there and make a difference in the world right away. And she's like, why do you have to do this now? Or at all? She's like, I don't want you to do this, and I don't like the fact you're doing it. And I was stubborn and did a terrible job of appreciating where she was at. I just, like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you go here and do something different? Why are you going to sit here? It was the way I was looking, right? And like, thank God we're still married, but I'm surprised she didn't leave me because I was just bare on my head and not that I didn't sit with her and cry with her and do that because I did, right? It's not like I wasn't completely ignorant, but I also wasn't going to change my direction.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, like she's still very private about it. She's not going to be up there talking, speaking on tour. She talks. If someone tracks her down and wants to talk, she'll probably have a conversation. But we're different. I think that's the biggest thing that people have to recognize when they're going through this is that the way my wife processes grief and the way I process grief are two different ways, but both okay with it. And you have to appreciate someone's way of getting through this and support each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the way my wife and I process grief was totally different. And once I understood that, we were able to support each other and give each other space to grieve as we saw fit. But we had to first understand our own unique grief process before we could support that and before we could respect it.
I think the early days were really, really hard. And I understand why people get divorced, right? Because you're having a good day, finally, right? And you come home, have a nice dinner with your wife or your family, and your wife's having a bad day. And all of a sudden, good day goes away.
Yeah.
She's having a good day and having a bad day. And you're constantly like this. You're just like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it costs a lot of fighting. Like, why are you bringing me down? Why do you have to do this? Why are you saying that? All that stuff happens. And it makes it really hard.
And yeah.
You have to work at it. And you have to appreciate and remember why you got married.
Yeah. And especially during times of challenge and trauma, we have to be patient with each other too and realize that, you know, even though we're married and there's a lot of alignment and similarity, there's still differences. We're different people and we are going to handle tragedy differently. We have to respect it, be patient, let it play out, and meet each other and support each other's expression of loss.
You don't expect someone to change.
No.
The way my wife is, the way my wife is. On the score, on that disc score, I'm 100 deep. I'm going to go make stuff happen. 0 and 100, I'm 100.
Mm-hmm.
Kim's D is 0. So she's yoga, walks, Sudoku, hanging with her friends.
Yep.
I have to accept my wife for who she is and love her the way she is and not expect her to change because she's not going to. And I'm not going to change if she has to accept me the way I am. Yep. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And it's so much more amplified after the loss of a child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Speaking of family in general, what are some of the specific challenges that you see surviving family members needing to deal with when the cause of death is suicide?
The stats are there, isn't it? Will this happen to another one of my kids? Because it does. If I miss this with one child, did I miss it with the rest of them? What are they going through? And then, you know, in my case, yes, I was a loving dad, but was I there completely emotionally for everybody? Probably not, because I was just working. You're okay, right? Good. I'm like, you all right? I'm fine. Fantastic. I'm glad you're fine. Okay. So now all of a sudden, I'm leaving you. Are you okay? Like, what's going on? Tell me what's really good. There. Who are you? No, you gotta tell me. I'm like, no, I don't. So connecting with my kids at a different, better level was a challenge. My daughter and I didn't speak for 2 years. Right after telling my story, she was in the movie, but then she took her mother's side and was really, which is fine, you know, against the movie and against everything I was doing. And we were just not talking. And she's very stubborn. She's exactly like me. And we went to a good couple of years. We did not even speak to each other. And that was really hard because that was like, I lost her and then I lost her. And Kim and I read ads on, and she's like, well, if I take your son, I'm going to lose her too. So I'm not going to do that. I'm like, well, that sucks. But that's reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was definitely worried about Kyle because he's more quiet. He came out with an album. He's a musician. He came out with an album a year after Ryan's death where it really showed how hard he took the death because he never talked about it. And I was scared to death after listening to the album. And he's like, no, Dad, it's just music. I'm like, well, those are your words, not just music. And you try to get your kids to, you know, they're all adults at this point, right, for the most part. So it's like, you say, okay, we need to get therapy. Your mom's getting therapy. I'm getting therapy. You need to do that. No, I don't. You can't force them to do things they don't want to do. So it was definitely hard. But, you know, fast forward to where we are now, and Ash and I are best friends. She lives on the property with her husband. We're fixing up a nice little house for them. They want to be here forever. You know, she works in a med spa that they have. And Derek is one of the top guys in my empire business. And him and his wife, Danielle, live just down the street. My granddaughter will be a year old in May. And Kyle's up in Portland. He works for me on a whole bunch of marketing stuff. And we're close. We went to London last year. So I'm back on these family trips. I used to take like San Diego, San Motel 6. And it was just the fact we got to go away together. So it's great now. But it took a lot of work and a lot of me understanding who I was and who I should be or wanted to be better.
Yeah, and it is when a death occurs, it affects everybody in the family. And sometimes the siblings get overlooked because everybody's concerned about the parents. And I'm glad that you were able to reestablish those relationships with your daughter and reestablish and find your ground again in a new world with your family and that you're close. And sometimes that doesn't happen in all cases with families who have experienced tragedy.
Yeah, but again, we worked at it, right? And we've got our family chat. We text each other regularly. And we're all going to Hawaii here next month. It's you have to work at it. And we talk, right? I talk to kids all the time. I joke with my wife, going, it's just as much work now and right out of the house as was when they're in the house.
Yeah.
But, you know, you hear all their issues, like, oh gosh.
I know. It's just all my, what I sign up for, my God, I become a father to thousands of kids now, yeah. You know, and, you know, with my students, they're a blast to be around. They kept me going, particularly in the early stages of grief when I was having trouble loving myself. They showed me a lot of love and respect, and they're just a blast to hang around. I've learned if you don't take half of what they do seriously, and when they're serious, you're there for them and you just kind of go with the flow with them. They'll connect with you and they'll want to be around you and they'll listen. They've spiced up my life more than I could have ever imagined. And I'm just thankful that I have them as part of my ongoing, and I call them extended family, but also they inspire me with their stories and they inspire me with their heart. And that keeps me going.
Sure.
So the only thing is, Jay, we got to figure out, since we have all these extended family members, you through Tell My Story and me through my students, we got to figure out how we can write them off on our income tax.
Well, since I pay a lot of mine, I actually do.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Maybe we could share some trade secrets later. I don't know. So, but yeah, that's the only thing I told myself. If I figure out how to write you off on my income tax, this would be an ideal marriage.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. I like to think that somebody's watching us.
Yeah.
And we're held accountable for what we do on this planet.
I think so. And every day we wake up is another day that we have an opportunity to do good. And we know that our mission on Earth isn't over yet, because every day we wake up, our mission's intact and our mission is ongoing. You had mentioned is that you would worried about if another one of my children was going to die by suicide. And I started to think, if I've lost one child, I could easily lose two. I could easily lose three. But I never let that fear consume me, because if I did, it would have prevented me from engaging and living. So I just tried to live every day to my best possible potential, to do some good in the world, be true to myself, and just take it a day at a time. But that, knowing that I could lose more, made life more precious for me too.
Well, I mean, I don't think I've ever told anybody this, but I still worry every day I'm losing somebody. I text my wife and she doesn't text me back. And I'm trying to pretend, I'm like, where the hell is she? Where's she driving? Is she okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I tell them, like, look, if I text you, respond.
Yeah.
No, wait.
Particularly the last communication you had with Ryan was a text message. So that, you know, that was, yeah, I can understand that. And plus, again, when the safety net is shattered, any type of delay in response, our head goes to the worst possible place. I think that's also a sign of the love that we have in our hearts for those that we have lost and those that we have remaining.
Yep.
You know, because we worry about losing people that we love unconditionally. Tell our audience about tellmystory.org. You established this, I know, after Ryan's death. What is the mission of the foundation, short-term, long-term goals, anything you want to share that will help our audience understand what Tell My Story is about?
Well, I'll tell you how it all came about is after Ryan passed, I was sitting up in my office that afternoon and I needed to do something. So I started thinking about what I would want Ryan to do, and I was looking for URLs on GoDaddy. And I thought, I wish he had chosen life. So I found that chooselife.org was available for $10,000. It's a lot of money.
No.
And I'm going, what a great name. So I got that name. I started my organization on chooselife.org, which was the original iteration of Tell My Story. And I did my first TED Talk. I actually mentioned chooselife.org. And then someone comes up to me, a good friend of me, goes, Jay, you know, that was the old anti-abortion organization from back in the 80s with Wham. Remember the, and like, oh, crap. Like, that's why it was $10,000. I'm like, I did the count. I'm going to go with it. And I was very arrogant because I was, you know, a business guy. And I thought, more arrogant back then than I am now. But I thought, like, everybody's doing it wrong. I'm going to end teen suicide by the year 2030 because somebody needs to do it. Everybody's talking about raising awareness. Like, everybody, put up your hand if you know about suicide. And I was like, everybody puts up their hand. I'm like, great. What are we doing about it? And so I thought I was going to be the guy who's going to change it all. And I ran afoul of pretty much every charitable organization in its space. No one wanted to deal with me. And then, of course, the Roe v. Wade being overturned changed everything. And I'm like, I'm not going to wear that t-shirt walking down in an airport and get in a fight with somebody or something. So I changed. I pivoted to Tell My Story because Tell My Story was, you know, the note that Ryan left me. And we did the movie tellmystory.org, or Tell My Story, changed the name of the organization Tell My Story, and changed the mission because I'm not going to end teen suicide. And I realized that there's a lot of really great people in the space. They're trying really, really hard to make a difference. The problem's just overwhelming.
Yep.
And so I narrowed down my niche to say that I want to help parents understand that they need to own their kids' mental health the way they own their kids' physical health. Because there's not enough good therapists, and there's not enough doctors, and there's not enough hospitals, and there's just not enough people to solve this problem. And we need to be there for our kids. Because what tends to happen is that your kid walks in and says, I'm sick, I don't want to go to school. And you're like, oh, you're lying. We're like, tell me where you're sick. I've got a stomach ache. Really? Yes. All right. Where is it hurt? It's right here. Really? And you poke in that spot, you're like, oh, that's not good. And you go, oh, you got a fever. Then you go, boom, get you to the hospital, right? Your kid walks in on Monday morning and says, I can't go to school. My boyfriend broke up with me and I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to be here. And we go, whoa, what are you talking about? You're going to be fine. He's an idiot. I always thought he was an idiot. You're the best looking person on the planet. There's nothing wrong with you. Get to school. You'll be fine. We don't let them talk. We go into protect them mode.
Yeah.
Like these, we're not trying to be jerks about it. I do the same thing, right? I did the same thing. But we need to own our kids' mental health. We need to understand it's a real thing. And I think, but we're doing a lot better job of it now than we used to, right? But even though there's a lot of parents that I see and they're just like, I had no idea until I watched your movies or saw your program that my kids might be thinking that. So my mission is to try and help everybody understand that. I do that through the movie Tell My Story, the movie What I Wish My Parents Knew, which is a school program that goes into schools across the nation. Dana puts that all out there for us. We've done the Tell My Story card deck, which is available on the website and now will be available on Amazon, which allows you to have conversations with your kids. And we get a lot of great feedback about these. Just little cards. Tell me what you think I should be proud of. Tell me what, I mean, it's, you'd be amazed that just a card starts a conversation. There's two albums we did, you know, Songs for the Drive Home and Take the Long Way Back, which just came out. It's on, you can go on any of your streaming services. And those are songs about mental health. The first album is like for kids. Side one's all for younger kids talking about mental health issues. Side two's for older kids. You play it in the car and you maybe it sparks a conversation. Your kids kind of Jack Johnson-y kind of music. The second one's more for adults. You grab a whole bunch of really cool artists and have them sing the songs. And my partner, Ken, does an amazing job. I help with some of the lyrics and this and that. But those albums are really part of what we do to try and make a difference. Our third album is in the works. And our next movie we just started filming last week is, we haven't got a name for it, kind of, it's called A Story of Hope. It's really, we were asked to put together something that shows kids that are helping themselves. I interviewed two amazing musicians, two girls, 18 and 20, who were actually on that album, talk to you about their mental health and what they do for mental health and how music helps elevate them, make them feel better. And we're going to be talking to musicians. We're going to talk to artists. We're going to be talking to, you know, anybody who leans into something as a kid, their mental health. And we're putting that into a 30-minute program for schools. The next big thing I'm going to do, and Dave, you and I didn't talk about this, but I do some work in AI. I've got an AI company. I have an AI event business. And I'm definitely afraid of what's going on with AI right now. And from a standpoint, I think this is the next big cliff in mental health with our kids. Because when you don't have to write your own texts and you don't have to write your own emails, you don't have to write your own essays, and you think that I wrote a song in ChatGPT, therefore I'm a musician, or I wrote a book in ChatGPT, therefore I'm an author, and you don't have to do any of your own thinking, and your friends are chatbots, we're going off a major cliff when it comes to mental health for our children. And I'll be filming a proper documentary in the fall about, you know, for lack of a better title, the AI dilemma. You know, the social dilemma came out on Netflix. It was a great film about, you know, what social media has done to our world. It also came out 15 years too late, right? It was 15 years after the start of everything. So I want to get ahead of this, and I'll be interviewing a lot of, you know, different people talking about what we need to be concerned about. And it's not robots taking over the world Terminator style. It's not using our brains and what happens when we don't. Not having human connection and what happens when we don't have that. And that's big weighing on my mind right now.
And human connection is so important to get through any challenge. We can't get through any challenge by ourselves. And certainly, like you said, AI bots aren't going to serve that purpose. We need to get back to genuine human connection and support and come together as communities to support individuals with a variety of challenges.
We have to, you can help your own kids. You can help your own friends. You just have to listen and not judge. Don't offer advice, they don't ask for it, and just listen and let them blow off that steam.
Yep. And just provide a safe, compassionate space for them to do what they need to do. And if they ask you for advice or options, work through the options together and help them come to a resolution in terms of what they're feeling and how they're feeling at that particular point.
But so, if they do have a plan to hurt themselves, you need to get to the hospital.
Absolutely. The more specific the plan, the more urgent it is to get that person seen and evaluated and hospitalized.
There's levels, as you know, Dave. It's like people who are sad and just thinking life sucks, and people who have planned to actually take their own lives. Mm-hmm. That is a serious mental illness issue that needs to be dealt with. They may need medication, they may need stronger therapy than we can give them personally, but they need to be taken care of and do not take it lightly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I impress upon my students. Somebody's talking about suicide, they're not looking for attention, they're thinking about doing it. And people who talk about suicide, eventually, most of them eventually end up attempting. So you err on the side of caution, you take it seriously, and if they have a specific plan, you move to crisis intervention mode and evaluation for inpatient hospitalization.
Yep. If you're uncomfortable talking to them because the conversation's going sideways, grab your phone, call 988 and get somebody on the phone.
Yep. Absolutely. And if we don't have the capability, or we feel we don't have the strengths to be able to hold space for somebody who's suicidal, we understand our limitations and turn it over to somebody who can effectively deal with the problem. Jay, if you could leave our listeners with one takeaway today, what would that be?
I would say, and this is not something you and I talked about before, but it's something that, again, is so heavy on my mind right now. When social media started, when Facebook hit the world, it damaged our mental health in ways that we had no idea was going to happen. AI, in my personal opinion, may be worse. It's going to be amazing for some people, but for the bulk of people, especially our children, they need to know how to have a life that connects with people. Yep. not computers. If you thought this was bad for our lives, AI is 10 times worse. Please be careful that your kids are talking to chatbots. Be careful that their only friends are chatbots or their best friends are chatbots. I worry about young men growing up having a chatbot girlfriend who only says nice things to them and never having a way to figure out how to communicate with a real woman. Because guess what? They don't say nice things very often.
No.
So I'm worried about that. As a parent, as a grandparent, my kids are past the age I need to worry about that too much. I worry about my grandkids. Yeah. So please, it's pay attention to where your kids are spending the time.
Yeah, that is good advice. And I think AI is good for some things, but it's not good for a lot of other things. And I think you have to know the difference.
It's going to change the world. I tell people it's jet fuel in my life. I can research things, figure things out. Yep. You know, I can just do amazing things with it. But I don't use it as a chatbot and a girlfriend. No.
Like everything, social media has a specific purpose. If you use it for a specific purpose, it's not going to become overwhelming. And it's the same with AI. If you have a specific purpose, that's fine. But to develop a relationship, like you said, with chatbots is not a healthy way to go or a healthy way to live. Jay, if people want to get in touch with you, find out more about tellmystory.org, find out more about just what you're doing in the world, what's the best way for them to do that?
You know, the easiest way to go is if you go to tellmystory.org and go to the Connect Contacts page. They will find me and talk to me. I'm happy to talk to people. Dana will help put what I wish my parents knew into your schools. We would appreciate any help with that. We want to make a difference. And all the stuff we do is free. I fund it all myself.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Actually, College Horse Painting, one of my companies, a lot of our clients donate, so they do actually make a good donation every year. Yeah. But everything is free for the schools.
That's generous, and it's an outpouring of love that you have for your son and the desire to make a difference in the world. So, Jay, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I truly enjoyed our conversation. I hope we can do this again in the future sometime.
I know we will. Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. And with that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.